This podcast is brought to you by the Marvel vs. Capcom Fighting Collection Arcade Classics. 7 legendary titles including X-Men vs. Street Fighter and Marvel vs. Capcom 2. Enjoy new features like online multiplayer, training, and gallery modes. Plus, join in on the action with one-button specials, where players of all skill levels can unleash those epic moves with ease. Relive the classic arcade battles. Get your hands on the Marvel vs. Capcom Fighting Collection today. Available now on PlayStation 4, PC, and Nintendo Switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games, with me continuing his truly miraculous recovery, the eighth wonder of the world, but a man that I have the pleasure and honor of simply calling douchebag, Michael Walker. How you doing, Walker?
Oh, sorry, I thought there was someone behind me there for a second. I'm doing great, Mark.
I'm glad to hear it.
How are you?
I'm doing very, very well.
Back from the deep, deep Ozarks.
No. Charleston Lake,
so many, Ontario. So many Bigfoot sightings.
No, I went camping. I will have more to say about camping in other venues, but this is a board gaming podcast about board games. And so we're going to be talking about board games this week. We're going to talk about our as-yet-unnamed retrospective intro segment, the Eurus. We're going to talk about the games we played this week, the news, and why it doesn't matter. And then we're going to close it out with our topic this week. Our topic this week is collection organization, which for Walker will be almost purely theoretical. For mine will be somewhat practical and also somewhat aspirational.
You promised me a branding pairing discussion. What good brandies go with camping? You said this was going to happen today. Do
you drink brandy at camping? I have known nobody more anti-alcohol than you, Walker. So I don't think
this is what makes.
I'm in point of fact amazed that you are willing to play board games in which you craft alcohol. I'm surprised you just don't get fundamentally disgusted by the prospect and reject.
It is an art.
Oh, definitely. Anyway. Let us talk about our as-yet-unnamed retrospective intro segment, the Eurus. Walker, what did we review last year?
Exactly. To the day, we reviewed Kinkopolis. That being said, I'm pretty sure I picked up a copy after we did the review.
Oh, do you still own it?
I still have it.
Ah, because my copy, I think I've owned Kinkopolis 2 or 3 times. It's one of those things where I get it, I trade it away, I get it, I trade it away. This is not a reflection on the game's quality. Kinkopolis is very good, I think. I'm always happy to play it. But it's not the kind of thing that I feel the deep drive to own. I don't know why that is. But we've played it a bunch of times on and off over the years. It's one of those things that's kind of in the background rotation. And it was kind of ahead of its time a little bit. It was released in 2012. And that was kind of before, maybe it was in the middle of the heyday of like mishmashing mechanisms together. It's got tiling, it's got drafting, it's got tableau building. But it does all of them pretty darn well, and the combination feels more focused and more intentional than a lot of other games that pull from a lot of different mechanisms.
It has 2 editions, so more likely you can get the newest edition, which does not include the expansion.
Still never played the expansion past the first time. It's got a bunch of different modules. None of them strike me as particularly impressive, and so I don't regret never having had more time to go back to it.
That's Kinkopolis.
By Javier Georges, published by Pearl Games. This is one of Javier Georges' lighter games, you know, compared to Black Angel and Trois and all those other things.
It's not only is it like a mash of mechanisms, it's also yet another, like, it's a sort of a multi-use card system as well.
Absolutely. I keep repeating this, and I say this every time I explain how the game works. The card flow is truly interesting. How cards cycle in and out of the system and how they end up in your tableau and how they start out unavailable, but then you lay a tile. And people, when they first start playing Kinkopolis, they try to wrap their heads around where cards go and why and when. I'm like, don't worry about it. It just shakes itself out. And it does. And it's just it's a really elegant system that you can't really, I think, internalize before the game starts. And consequently, I'm not even going to try to describe it in detail because I would fail to get anyone to internalize it. But if you've played, you know.
Would you be able to say that it could break if you don't keep on top of adding the cards into the system?
If you make a mistake, the game will not break. So if you fail to introduce cards when they're supposed to be introduced, and to be fair, to Kinkopolis, there are lots of tracking components that exist exclusively to do it. If you fail to introduce those cards, then the game won't break. If you fail to introduce any of the new cards, yes, the game will break. The game will stall. But you can forget one or two and it'll be fine. It will give an unintentional advantage to some players, naturally, because their tiles won't be coverable. You can't ever overbuild on top of them. But the game continues to function. Unlike, say, many an app-driven game without a back function.
Yes.
So, that is the game we reviewed roughly a year ago, Ginkopolis. Now we move on to the games we played last week. Walker, what did you play last week?
I got Gnar to the table. Gnar is a fantastic, quick-playing card game by Thomas DuPont and put out by Bombyx Games. You have five different sort of rows that you're going to add Vikings to that are different colors, or you're going to be adding to this overall sort of board state where you can go for a trade and you run these different lines. I don't want to go right into the rules, but you have these three sort of bracelets that you can collect, and either before your action or after your action, you can spend these bracelets to run one, two, or three lines of these sort of tableau building cards that you're going to acquire, and it's going to get you victory points. You have this reputation track that you can sort of focus on and get automatic points at the beginning of every turn. You have these decisions that you have to make when you want to buy these tableau building cards, because you have to destroy your rows of Vikings in order to buy them. So you have to decide when that is best to do that and when it's, you know, not so advantageous. You also have to look at the cards that are available, because once you play a card to a line, then you're going to get a card back. Depending on the color that you play, it tells you which card you're going to get back. So that's also a decision you have to think of. Well, I really want that card. I don't have any helmets to, you know, bypass that. So I'm just going to play this red card to get its benefit, just to get that card, because when it comes my turn again, it's going to be amazing. I love everything about it. The production, the art, the how fast it flows, introduced a new player, they seem to enjoy it. Gnar.
So many games try to replicate this feature of destroying the engine you've built in order to cash in for benefits. And to a certain extent, I think Gnar, despite being vastly faster and simpler, does it better than a lot of its heavier competitors, because you're very strongly incentivized and tempted in many contexts to just build up a very, very long chain of cards of the same color. Because every time you play to a color, you get all the benefits of that color. But then there are these big victory point cards that you can purchase by cashing in your infrastructure. And so you're constantly tempted to undermine your infrastructure at the same time. And if you just focus on a monocolor, building up this pseudo engine, it's not really an engine. I realize I'm being somewhat metaphorical when making these comparisons. But you just don't have the flexibility. Like, yeah, you've got 12 red cards, but a lot of the terrains to buy those big points, you need a couple of reds, maybe, but then a green or a yellow or what have you, and you're just locked in. So
you've also reduced the card pool of all those reds. So it's true. Less reds are coming up. So
it's true. That's an excellent point. Yeah, it gets a lot of things right in a tight experience, and that is exactly what you want out of a small box filler length game. I think Gnar is really one of those games that I hesitate to even call it a filler. Like, there are lots of fillers that I adore. For Sale is wonderful. Tons of dexterity fillers that we play. Don't Llama Dice that we pull out all the time. Lots of quicker trick-taking games. But Gnar has some of those big, weighty economic trade-offs that I associate with heavier Euros. And so I tend to resist the characterization, even though filler characterizes a lot of what it's doing. That's Gnar. Played another game of Primal the Awakening. Possibly, if I'm lucky, my last. It's not that I hate Primal the Awakening. It gets a lot of things right. It's a big, big box, tons of large boss miniature, boss battler campaign things. But the campaign elements bore me. There's so much flavor text, and I don't know if it manifests towards something near the end of the campaign. The rulebook told me to take notes and start speculating as to what various prophetic dreams might mean, and I cannot be bothered. Maybe it coalesces into something interesting, but so far I've yet to encounter a person, place, or thing that remotely excites my imagination, so who cares? And on top of that, I am game daddy, and so I have to run everything, and there's paperwork involved, and there's not a lot of paperwork involved, but there's just enough. And then the gameplay drags just enough. So there's it's a card-driven combat game where you're fighting a boss. And there's not a whole lot of maneuver involved, which is potentially okay. but the way that it renders not a whole lot of maneuver feels a lot less like something like Claustrophobia or Doomrock, where you feel like it's doing something very efficiently, and instead feels a little bit more like you're kind of stuck in place, because sometimes you need to be on the other side of the map, or you, whenever you need to really get moving somewhere, you can't, because monsters are only vulnerable at certain sides. And too many monsters too often engage in something we talked about last week, which is the attack against you causes you to discard a card. Or the attack, the boss that we killed this time, the giant crab, there are actually contexts where it will cause you to skip a turn. Fortunately, we lucked into a situation where that never triggered. But every time that card came up, I'm like, oh, this one. Oh, yeah. No, don't worry. It doesn't happen. Oh, good. Because on top of the fact that it's a skip a turn mechanism, it involves a whole bunch of nested keywords, and the keyword and icon management in Primal is like classic Kickstarter job, not particularly well done. Look, if you want a new boss fighting game and you've already finished Oathsworn, then maybe Primal is worth kind of sort of a look. Maybe. But Oathsworn is a boss battler that does everything so much better, and the campaign was so much better on top of that. Maybe you really want something that's like Monster Hunter. Fine. If Monster Hunter is your jam, and there are Monster Hunter people, there are people who just live, breathe, eat, and sleep Monster Hunter, maybe Primal the Awakening is for you.
Leviathan Wilds?
Leviathan Wilds doesn't have that same kind of structure of tearing something apart to make your new toys.
Oh, I suppose.
That is the fundamental loop. It's like, behold this monstrous creature of legend. I'm going to turn its guts into a pinky ring. That's the sort of vibe that I'm talking about.
Gotcha. That fang will make a cool sword. I'm going to cut its head off. Gotcha.
Exactly. And so Primal Awakening, it does a better job than so many other games of its ilk. And if I were in a slightly different group, if things could move slightly faster, either by virtue of the scenario design or the AI design, or because other people were carrying more of the load, or if it were slightly better edited, then I'd be willing to continue playing Primal the Awakening, frankly. Which is something of a minor accomplishment, given that it's a campaign-style game that I'm not interested in. But the core element of the card combos and the hand management, pretty well done. It's just drowning in a sea of other stuff that I just don't have any interest in, so... Those are the further experiences of Primal the Awakening. I will say that the second half of Crab Fight went much, much faster than first half of Crab Fight. All told, Crab Fight took about 3.5 hours, which, given that the first half took over 2, I was very nervous that Crab Fight was just going to go on forever, but we finished off Crab. There is a sort of ramping up of Primal the Awakening. You have this thing, which another clever element, it's got this thing called a mastery card. As you level up, you can choose from different mastery cards, and it has a condition on it. Like, every time you do this, every time you play a red card followed by 2 yellow cards, put a token on this card. You do that a couple times, it flips over, now you've got a new badass special ability. So it's kind of like leveling up inside every session, as well as across different sessions. And we had all kind of leveled up by that time, so when Crab 2 went much, much faster than Crab 1.
Do you get to build a battle tank out of Crab?
Sadly, no.
But it's so easy, right? You just put the axles through the...
Somebody had already deployed a 20-foot long shell cracker that you find at Red Lobster, and it was too late by that point. They had the melted butter. It was a whole thing.
Well, at least it was... Yeah.
Wasted opportunities.
I agree.
So that was Primal the Awakening by Tommaso Mondadori and Alberto Parisi and Reggie Games. I'll probably try to give it to a patron. Ready to pay tremendous quantities of money in shipping? It's big.
All or nothing.
Yeah, exactly.
We got Beowulf Legend to the table based off our Aurus that we talked about last week. This is designed by Ryder Knizia and put out by Fantasy Flight Games. And can you categorize this as an IP game? Did it come out roughly the same time as the movie did?
It did, but there was published by Fantasy Flight, Ryder Knizia game that was a movie tie-in. This is not a movie tie-in. This is a tie-in to the original.
Yes, there's no movie art in this. Yes, this is completely original stuff.
Yes.
Well, based on the
myth. And it's got original art by John Howe that is evocative of the events of the epic poem.
And this has a lot of stuff that Ryder Knizia is known for, i.e. auction stuff that is fantastic. You sort of have a Beowulf figure and it moves along his adventures of Beowulf. And it just sort of engages all sorts of different auctions that you're going to do with this hand management type game where it's asking for certain symbols and either you're doing a one-time auction or a incrementally increasing auction and it has a whole risk factor that you get to do as well. That's somewhat interesting. and it has a lot of choices. Like when you win the auction, it's just not straight up, you know, well, you win, you get this. There's choices there, and it's not always the same. You know, there's not always an obvious choice. It's either healing yourself. There's a little bit of, you know, push your luck as it comes to the wounds.
And, tremendous quantities of push your luck. Absolutely. And,
you know, take victory points, or, you know, you can get some scrolls, which could be a little bit of, you know, gambling as well.
A little bit of the gambler.
Or you can get money, because you need money as well, because there's some money auctions. All sorts of interesting stuff. Beowulf the Legend.
I love hand management. I love hand management when it's done super well. And Beowulf does hand management nearly the best I've ever seen, because you look at the board, there's this progress going on, you know what auctions are coming up, you know when and for what purpose the different suits are going to be valuable. You can decide what to do and try to figure out a sort of long-term strategy. You can be eating it really badly in the middle sections, possibly deliberately, to make a big comeback. Like, I was doing very, very poorly in the first half of Beowulf, but I was slowly gathering money. And I was able to use my money advantage to just dominate all the money auctions in the back half of the game. And that propelled me to a pretty good score. I felt very, very good about that. And I really like the fact that there's just this path that you're following. It looks a little bit like Candyland to some people because, you know, Beowulf is just walking along. It's like, and now Beowulf is fighting Grendel. And that's a different kind of auction. So I've talked a lot about how Beowulf, I think, is criminally underrated in the hobbyist board game sphere. And one of the reasons why I think is people underappreciate how well-themed it is, because it is about taking risks and doing kind of bro-y Geatland warrior stuff and trying to outdo your friends when fighting the dragon when probably you should take a breather and go on home.
Yeah, it's not always an all-or-nothing sort of risk either. It's
yes.
Because as soon as someone goes out, they take the 5 and then the 4, then the 3, the 2, the 1. So you can just sort of look at the rewards and say, well, I'm okay with 4th as long as I don't get 5th.
Yes.
So you just sort of limp in just enough and then you go out and save your cards.
And to contrast it with, again, a game I really like, For Sale. In For Sale, broadly speaking, what happens, not all the time, but the moment somebody passes, I call it pulling the ripcord, because everybody else tends to pass in quick succession after there's an initial pass. Sometimes that happens in Beowulf the Legend, but sometimes you have these tremendous fights, then someone drops out, and then somebody else drops out right away. But then there's another tremendous fight because somebody else doesn't want to be third, they want to be second or first. And so there's this weird staggered competition by virtue of the fact that the rewards are so different and they fit into your overall strategy in different ways. And I love the tension. I just love it. And I love the fact it's got one of those elements. It uses luck in addition to the way that it uses hand management. It uses luck in one of my favorite ways, which is if you position yourself properly, you can gamble knowing that there's no way you can lose, right? Knizia masters probabilistic luck and gambling better than anybody else, I think, in the industry. And in Beowulf, and this is one of the reasons why people hated it. People hated Beowulf when it was first released. They're like, how could Reiner Knizia release such a thing? It's all about who pulls the better cards. No, it's knowing when you're in a position to pull the handle on the slot machine and knowing when it is too dangerous to do so. And if you're in a position where you can afford to lose, yeah, you're going to look like you're luckier because you can, I call it playing with house money. But that's all part of situating yourself properly in the context of, oh, it's such a good game.
Yeah, and then you have the risk, and then you also have, if you pay attention to what people want, it's like, oh, I really want to win this auction so I can get this.
Right.
And then you look at who's going against you, and it's like, they're not going to choose that.
Yeah.
I'm just going to bow out and go second because I know they're going to take the healing or the gold.
They're
something.
Not in a position to extend themselves in the way that I am.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. It is a game that I will never get rid of. It's been in my collection ever since it got published. I'm never... And for what it's worth, again, all these criticisms that I hear levied against Beowulf, I've never heard anyone who's played the game in my presence do those things. Now, either because they're humoring me. It has been observed on occasion I'm not pleasant to argue with.
Lies.
No, but you understand what I'm saying. I've read all these complaints for years from people on the internet. I have not encountered a human in the real world that has played Beowulf and said, I don't like it. It wins converts. Not everyone is as big a fan of Beowulf as I am after playing it, but it's so well done. I'm a huge fan. I would also like to give a brief shout out once again to the somewhat recent translation of the epic poem by Maria Devana Headley, whose opening line of this rendition is, "Bro, tell me we still know how to talk about kings." Because there's this, not to get too far into the weeds, there's this word, what, which is very difficult to translate, and it basically means, hey, everybody, come up and listen. I'm about to tell you something. And Maria Devonna Headley has decided to render this as bro, which is just, I very much appreciate it. That is Beowulf the Legend, not to be confused with Beowulf the movie game, which is something else entirely. I decided to play Pavlov's House, some discussion of the Valiant Defense series last week, and of the fact that the new one about Guadalcanal is supposed to be a riff on Pavlov's House, but it does not involve the designer David Thompson. David Thompson is the originator of the Valiant Defense series, and Pavlov's House was indeed the first one published in 2018. This is a review copy we got from the designer, and Pavlov's House is different from the other Valiant Defense series games in that, as I always mention, it has a strategic horizon as well as a tactical horizon. In order to get supplies, in order to protect your soldiers, in order to deploy new soldiers, in order to get other bennies and get weapons and ammunition, there's this other card play element that happens in the first part of every phase. And this interplay, I really appreciate. It really opens up the scope. I also appreciate it when the Valiant Defense series gets very, very close and personal, like in Soldiers and Postmen's Uniforms, which really zoomed in. We're talking about a small geographic area, a small number of people, each of them named, and many of them civilians. But I also appreciate Pavlov's House, which is a more traditional consim type of historical engagements, and indeed Pavlov's House has been rendered in a number of different historical war games. But I really like the series as rendered by David Thompson. He always picked interesting conflicts to model and model in interesting ways. And I really enjoy Pavlov's House. There's a digital version. There's the physical version. Both of them are equally worthy, I think. And I really enjoy Pavlov's House as a solo game. It is one of my preferred historical solo war games. And I got completely trounced because one of the reasons why I'm not very good at Pavlov's House is because it requires a certain degree of initiative and a certain degree of risk-taking. I look at Pavlov's House, both literally and metaphorically, and I think this is a game about defending Pavlov's House. Well, it is and it isn't, because in order to win the game, you actually have to organize sorties. You have to get soldiers together, and you have to send them out to go clear neighboring buildings. Those are a big source of your victory conditions. I'm really bad at that. I want to keep my own house a little nice and tidy, and I want to keep my defense lines clear, and I don't want to get distracted. I don't want to start thinking about going on the offense. No, no, no. And so I really need to be better at doing that if I want to do well at Pavlov's House. But I enjoy losing. I nonetheless got to... Pavlov didn't make it, though, unfortunately. I did the worst of all possible worlds. I realized belatedly, oh, darn, I have to really go and start doing a sortie. But then I did it badly, and I scrambled at the last minute. Didn't go well. Anyway.
There is a digital version of this that I have that I haven't even tried yet, so I should load it up and give it a whirl.
It's reasonably well done. It's got a tutorial. It moves along at a good clip. It doesn't do a great job of... This is one of my chief beefs with Pavlov's House, particularly with the strategic horizon. The cards could have done a better job of indicating what they do in the strategic phase, because they just indicate the kind of thing you're activating. It's like, this activates the Volga River platoon. It's like, okay. Could you use some of that blank space to tell me or remind me a little bit about how those work in terms of roles? No. So, you know, get a good player aid, and the PC version does a good job of handling a lot of rules, but it doesn't do the thing that I wish it did, where you mouse over it would tell you exactly what's going on.
I wonder if it'd be cool to do both at the same time. I remember doing that with chess, that I would play chess online a lot, but I would also have the board set up beside me and move the pieces physically.
Oh, sure.
Is there something about just, you know, visualizing it?
Absolutely.
In real life, as opposed to...
Yeah, at that point, though, I don't know what virtue you're getting out of the digital version, frankly, because...
Like I said, like, I don't know how much it handles, so I don't know.
Well, I mean, it handles everything, but it's a solo game, and it's not really that complicated in terms of upkeep. That's one of the reasons why I love it so much as a solo game. It's very straightforward, especially when compared to a lot of the other historical monsters. Anyway, I highly recommend Pavlov's House to people who like historical wargaming, as well as to people who don't like historical wargaming. Designed by David Thompson, published by Danvers and Games, 2018.
I'm going to talk about Deep Rock Galactic again. Only because, like, if a game like this keeps coming to the table, then there must be something about it. I'm still enjoying it. It's about a bunch of space dwarves that work for a corporation, and they're sent in there to bring back unobtainium. Very hard to get unobtainium, Mark.
Yeah.
All right. This is designed by Ole Steinis and put out by Mood Publishing, and it's a all-versus-the-game type thing. And like I said, you're given a mission of, you know, finding, usually so far, there could be all sorts of different things. We've only played like the first four or so. You know, find this number of things and they're under hidden tokens, and then mine this number of this particular ore, and then you're under a time limit. So lots of things, and then you have to keep all the bugs at bay because they don't like you just stealing their ore. It's their ore.
Oh, this is the bug's ore.
It's the bug's ore.
Oh, okay.
It has nothing to do with the fact that you're cracking open their eggs and destroying their young.
Is this space colonialism?
Okay. You know, they deserved it.
Oh, all right.
Anyway, lots to enjoy. Keeping track of your ammo. It's a lot more puzzly. I wish it was more puzzly. There's like lots of special abilities. You're ziplining across pits. You're breaking into new parts of the dungeon. Because it's sort of like a dungeon crawler. Anyway, lots to love about Deep Rock Galactic.
We played another game of Capital X 2 Generations. This is by Eilis Svensson and Christian Amundsen Osby, a design team who has done a number of games that we very much appreciate, published by Aporta Games. This is not a review copy. This was a gift from Eric Royce, designer of Spirit Island. So there you go.
So, yeah, I hate talking about Capital X 2 only because it's so hard to get. And it's so good.
both of those things are true. It's very much out of print. One of my big problems with playing Capital X 2 well, not that playing games badly is at all a problem. I think it's great, actually. I talked about this on Bloat, that hobby gaming is an environment where people get to be terrible at something in public and there's no shame attached. Unlike, say, singing or dancing, where if you sing or dance really badly, people tend to make fun of you. At any rate, the problem I often find is that activating the special abilities, playing with the cool toys in the sandbox, sometimes it's a distraction. Sometimes, in point of fact, it's just opening the window for someone else to do something good. And this doesn't rise to the level of the fun play being at odds with the smart play, but it's just a risk, right? It's just, if you do it too much, you're just handing other people opportunities. And so I find myself saying, it's like, ooh, this card that I have in my hand could be done to go activate some sort of special power, and then I get to play with the rocket ship. Or I could play it to my own board, and it's worth 6 points. I should probably play it to my own board. I'm getting a little bit better at resisting the siren call of activating too many special powers, but that tension is indeed very good.
Yeah, there's so much timing in Capital X 2. So what you're doing is that you're playing cards to your tableau in suits, because if you have the most in your tableau of a particular suit, you're going to win, and you get to take the highest scoring card from the capital. Now, the capital works that each suit has to be
that level or lower. That level is the limit.
So you have to make sure the capital is getting the same number of the same type of cards that you're putting in your tableau.
My tableau has 12 green. Oh, but the capital only has 10 green. That's a problem. I'm going to lose everything by the end of the round if that doesn't change.
It's simply just gone.
Yeah.
Then on top of that, playing to your own tableau does not give you any special abilities. Playing to the capital not only increases the total, but gives you the special ability of that suit. Now, on top of all this, as soon as someone plays the last card out of their hand, everyone gets one more turn. And then all of the cards that are left in your hand, because there are all sorts of different abilities that bring more cards into your hand, all of the cards that are in your hand automatically get put into your tableau.
Whether you want it or not.
Which, as we just said, could put you over the total. So you're looking at what's in your hand, and you're trying to time it all out. It's like, I don't want to be caught with these cards. I don't want to play it into my tableau because it's sort of going to reveal what you're trying to do.
Exactly.
I don't want to put it into the capital because that raises the total for everyone. And also, you know, activates a special ability that's going to mess up this other line that I have. So many interesting things. And on top of that, before the game even starts, every suit, like we said, has a special ability, but there's like a stack of... There's four different special abilities for each suit. So the game's going to be, I don't want to say completely different, because it plays basically the same, but...
Yeah, the fundamental contours don't change. It is nice window dressing, though.
Just so. Anyway, love everything about Capital X 2. It plays at a great clip. It just goes for 3 rounds, and then you're done. The fact that, you know, you can sort of... Someone might feel as though they're winning because they have a ton of points in their tableau and the total in the capital is right. But then someone plays a special ability that lets them remove one of those cards from the capital, and suddenly they're way over and now they're going to bust and they don't have the cards in their hand to fix that. Interesting things like that. because, like I said, they revealed their intent too soon.
They showed their hand too soon. And sometimes it's even literally their fault because you draft your cards at the top of the round. So you know what's in circulation. You have a general sense of a fair amount of what's around. And if you know that special ability to nuke the center tableau, which puts you at risk, is in play, well, be careful. Plan around that.
So if you're at a game night, someone has Capital Lux 2, play it while you can, because you will not be disappointed.
I was desperately afraid you were going to say something about trying to steal their copy. I was very worried that
goes without saying. Mark, I got Trolls and Princesses back to the table. We played this a while ago, and it has a great theme, has a great production, and I remember enjoying it. I enjoyed it this much more because I actually did go back and listen to the podcast where we talked about it.
You listened to this podcast?
I did.
I do not recommend that to anyone.
I know. I did, though. I gritted my teeth, and
What caused the stroke?
It could have been. Anyway, the main disappointment we had with Trolls and Princesses was the downtime and the fact that it went slow. I played it two players, and man, did this clip along very quickly. We got right down to it. What you're doing in Trolls and Princesses is that you're kidnapping humans to help your trolls in the mines.
Adorable little baby meeples, yes.
You're also switching your children with the human children so they'll grow up to be on your side. You're stealing their bells because a lot of this stuff is very accurate to the...
Accurate. It's evocative of very particular folklore.
Of European accurate troll folklore.
Accurate is a strange word. I understand where you're coming
apparently
from.
Apparently trolls very, very much hate church bells or just bells in general. So you steal the bells and all this stuff covers up parts on your map and you grow out your troll caves and you steal princesses and you make them fancy beds.
Oh, no, you make the fancy bed first. True. You can't steal the princess before you got the fancy bed.
Well, they have nowhere to sleep then.
Of course.
And the fancy princess must sleep.
You have to give them the fanciest cave.
So it's one of these games where I was enjoying it so much, I did not even look at the scoring conditions, which I should have, because you need combinations of bells and you're putting out outposts. It's a worker placement game where the more workers you have, you have five worker trolls and you're moving them around the board, and the more trolls you have in an area, the more powerful actions it generates a certain number of points, and then you spend those points on the actions that are available in that spot.
One of my key objections to Trolls and Princesses wasn't even about its runtime or the downtime necessarily. It's just I felt that to a large extent the scoring was much ado about nothing. It was very difficult. It was one of those multi-conditional things, not entirely unlike Terminus, where you needed to have the necessary four resources in order to get something done. And you do that two or three times over the course of the game, and you think, it's like, okay, well, I just played this, 90-minute Euro game, and I only got a couple princesses. It felt a little bit deflating. I imagine, though, with two, that would, again, the runtime would be so much lower, and that would help, but it would also help a little bit with how I felt that taking advantage of other players' trolls was just too arbitrary rather than opportunistic. But with two players, it would make a lot more sense because, your opponent makes a big commitment somewhere. You're like, okay, well, now I know, and I can plan around that a little bit more going forward rather than just the weird sea of three or four players shifting out too much.
So Trolls and Princesses is designed by Pim Thurborg and put out by the late Game Brewer.
Played Drow Polter. This is a bizarre little Oink Games game in the adorable little box. And I have to say, the adorable boxes, they managed to find a way to stuff those adorable boxes chock full of everything. Because the way Drow Polter works, the theme is something about poltergeists. So it's a game about dropping, and it's called Drow Polter.
Well, you see, Mark, I do. You obviously do. You have trinkets beside your bed, like special talismans, right?
Yeah.
To scare away ghosts.
Yeah. And so I don't want to be unprepared when the ghost
exactly.
comes.
Exactly. So
like some sort of chump.
So a ghost wakes you up. You have to identify the type of ghost it is.
Yeah.
And then drop the appropriate trinket that scares away that ghost.
Yeah, you drop the wrong trinket. It's not going to work.
Exactly.
I'm sorry. I didn't say that because it's so obvious.
So it sort of helps you practice for real life situations.
It's a training tool, really. The German title of the game is Holter die Polter, which roughly translated... I'm not making this up. Very loosely translated is bring the noise. I have to assume that the expansion pack will be called bring the funk. Anyway, so you have these trinkets, and they're literally trinkets. Only a couple of them are made of wood. There's this plastic ring. There's this weird lucite cube, which is supposed to be a gem. And in real time, you flip over a card and it's going to tell you which of the five which subset of trinkets you need to drop. One to four of these trinkets. And everybody must then, from their hand, not using the other hand, drop the specific trinkets from their hand onto the table. It is so weird. And then it gets weirder.
Yes, it doubles down on the awesomeness.
Because what happens when you win a round, Walker?
You get a point, Mark. You get a nice little bell token as a point.
Lovely. Do I get to keep the bell in front of me?
Oh, no, Mark. That bell will go in your hand.
What happens if I drop the bell accidentally?
Well, you lose those points, silly.
Oh, no. And so it's like many great weird dexterity games. It's an opportunity to play with toys as an adult and just watch people engage in such frustration and frantic energy over these weird little cheap... I use cheap here as a term of endearment. Little baubles that they need to be manipulated. It's great.
It sort of gives this Lots vibe. That was like the crowdfunding thing that we were talking about a while ago where the designer just threw handfuls of gaming and toy components into a box and sent it to you with all
random detritus, yes.
Yes. So every box is the same of this game.
Yes.
But it's like a plastic ring and a red square.
Red cube that's supposed to be a gem.
And then waffle yellow thing.
It's supposed to be a biscuit of some sort.
It feels as though they sort of called up the component company. It's just like, what do you have a lot of that we can get for cheap?
Yeah,
it's like, well, we have a bunch of bells. Oh, yeah, we'll take those bells. And someone made a ghost game, but never... Yeah, okay, we'll take ghosts and some red cubes. And then, okay, throw it in a box. It's a game. But it works, and it's fantastic.
I didn't have an opportunity to try the advanced rules because in the basic rules, what happens is you basically shake everything up and then you have to drop them from your palm using one hand. In the advanced rules, what you do is you shake them up and you have to leave your fist closed and drop things from your closed fist. That, I think, would be an additional level of difficulty, but also I worry that we frequently talk about dexterity games possibly benefiting people that are either larger or smaller than each other. I think this is the first time where I look at something and say, definitely, like, yeah, bigger hands, it'd be an advantage in this case. Then again, maybe not. I've been surprised in the past, but I'd be vaguely curious to try the advanced rules for Dropolter, suffice to say.
Well, this game was brought to rehab and was a huge hit and was written down and added to the list.
Great. Well, I mean, given that it is, even by our standards, super obscure and hard to find.
Yeah, I told her. I said, you know, I was loath to bring it only because I couldn't even find a copy for myself. We had to borrow this copy.
We had to borrow it from someone. Yeah.
And so hopefully it gets a big reprint because I definitely want my own copy.
Well, Oink Games does reprint things semi-regularly, and they released it. This is a release from last year, so who knows? Maybe this will get on their calendar of reprints. That is Dropolter by Paul Schultz, published by Oink Games.
Lastly, from me, we are asked for our opinions on a new game called Gnome Hollow. So I picked up a copy. This is designed by Amund Andersen and put out by The OP. Now, Mark, have you ever said to yourself, I like Carcassonne, but I really wish we could play with just building the roads? And that player interaction stuff, I hate that. Let's pull all of that stuff out and just build roads.
So the kids' version of Carcassonne, my first Carcassonne, is only roads, but there is player interaction.
Because, yeah, oof.
A little bit.
So yes, I don't want to go too negative on this, but even just from reading the rule book, I was pre-spoiled, I'm not sure, but anyway.
Oh, review discounting sarcastic comment number 27. You decided you didn't like it before you started it. There you go.
I didn't play it right, Mark.
Yeah, you didn't play it right. Yeah.
There are two ways to play it.
L2P, you didn't play it right. You wanted it to be something else. We can just list them all off.
We should list them because, you know, when we ever talk about arcs, we get those and we could just, you know, we could get back and forth. So in Gnome Hollow, there's two ways to play. And it's not so much like the baby way and the grown-up way. It's more like the standard way and the advanced way. We played the standard way where when you make a path, when you close off the ring, you just count the number of tiles. And you move some cylinders accordingly. The advanced way to play is that you have to actually make certain shapes of the roads.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. People have said when we were streaming it, if you're interested in the game, we did stream it. Check out our live channel on YouTube. We just played it this Saturday. And so it was hard enough to close some circles that you didn't have to have a particular shape. Imagine if you had like actual tiles that you needed, would make it that much harder. Depending on the player order, I need a straight. I need this. There are not that many in the game. Maybe if one other person needs it, you play two tiles and you flip up new tiles to the sort of pool. And look, we flipped up a straight. Oh, that person took it. I won't get it this round. And you only have two gnomes that are like the Carcassonne workers where you can save a road. This is my road. No one else can go on that road. You can't even join roads like you did in Carcassonne.
Sure.
And try to take over the road. Nor can you play a road on my road unless you ask me for permission. So people can sort of build close to you and sort of limit what pieces that you can now use to finish that road. And then once you finish a ring, you count the number of tiles. There's going to be a bunch of mushrooms on that ring. So you'll get the mushrooms, which you're going to sell later. And then you're going to...
You're building roads.
You're building roads.
You're selling mushrooms.
You're selling mushrooms.
This sounds like... Correct me if I'm wrong. Especially compared to something like Trolls and Princesses, it really seems like Noel Hollow wanted to suck out all the whimsy from this kind of setting.
Yeah, it seemed odd.
Okay.
And then you get to bring one of your cylinders down from the far left. As you bring these cylinders down, you get more points. And then it's like, oh, I made a five-tile road. I can go down the five column and put it in that five column. It can only be five for the, you know what I mean? It's not five or less. It's only five. And once you fill that column, you can't do any more rings. You'll still get the mushrooms, but you won't get any cylinders. And sometimes, you know, there'll be a little mini Benny in that particular column of the five. Anyway, I'm not going to go right into the rules. I was hoping there'd be more of a game because, like I said, you only have two gnomes. And there's a bunch of different things you can do with those gnomes, i.e., like I said, you can save a path or you can go sell your mushrooms. You need to use a gnome for that. You can use your gnome for getting more flowers. There's multiple places.
So, stealing underpants.
Yeah, so sometimes you'll have to... This is where I got into a problem was... I got a little too ambitious on a couple of my... At the beginning, I said, oh, I'll do some smaller paths so I don't... Because a couple of people got into that problem at the beginning. A little too ambitious. And so their gnomes were sort of locked on the board. And I got into that problem in the mid-game. And so I abandoned one of my paths. And then, like I said, once you... The other people that were doing smaller paths got these things called wild tiles. And then go anywhere and connect to anything you want them to. So I abandoned a path. And then immediately... Someone got a straight that, say, I needed. They got the straight and they had these wild tiles. So they just finished my path that I couldn't because they had the wild tiles and they got the draw they wanted. So this long path that I had abandoned and slowed me down for the whole game, which, you know, you could say it was my fault.
L2P nub.
Exactly. So I lost the timing, lost the stuff. Person in behind is even now more behind. Person that was ahead is now more ahead. Anyway, I was hoping that the mini game sort of at the end of all your turns where you moved your gnomes around and decide where they went. I was hoping that would be a little more robust, but in the end it was a little hollow. And that is Gnome Hollow. I'm loath to say I want to show it to you, but I'd be interested to see what you thought as well.
Oh,
so maybe
really?
We'll get to it.
This is like one of those hazing rituals, right?
It is also on Board Game Arena, which I'm going to talk about very soon.
Those are the games we played last week, and now a brief break while we pay some bills.
This podcast is brought to you by the Marvel vs. Capcom Fighting Collection Arcade Classics. Seven legendary titles, including X-Men vs. Street Fighter and Marvel vs. Capcom 2. Enjoy new features like online multiplayer, training, and gallery modes. Plus, join in on the action with one-button specials, where players of all skill levels can unleash those epic moves with ease. Relive the classic arcade battles. Get your hands on the Marvel vs. Capcom Fighting Collection today. Available now on PlayStation 4, PC, and Nintendo Switch.
And we're back. And now on to the news and why it doesn't matter.
Like I said, Board Game Arena. Gnome Hollow is on there. If you wanted to give it a try, you can play it there. Other games that are in alpha. I've decided, Mark, I'm not going to do this bit about things that are not.
Is this personal growth? I don't think I've ever seen you drop a bit.
If they want to ban me for talking about alpha games, if they want to, you know, if they want me to stop bringing traffic to their website, then so be it.
Sure, sure.
Orleans and Darwin's Journey are both in alpha on Board Game Arena, and I'm enjoying those implementations Very much.
Oh, that's great.
I love Orleans, and they do some shortcuts on Orleans where you can like pre-program so you're all, you know, sort of ready, and then you just...
Oh, great.
Go through the actions. They have all, most of the expansions on there, like the building expansions.
Yeah, those tiny little, yeah.
Yeah, not the big expansions.
Right.
Darwin's Journey, fantastic so far. The only thing I wish they had added to Darwin's Journey right now is the fact that, I don't know if you remember Darwin's Journey, but you have a sort of a boat path that you go on, yep, and an adventurer path. And when you mouse over other people's boats, you can't see what's underneath it. So you're sort of wondering, oh, if do I want to pause here and not move my adventurer because I want to wait for them to move off so I can,
right,
take what they had, so you can't really see. Anyway, Orleans implementation is done by Jord Jansson, and the Darwin implementation is done by Einstein Jojob. Patron was nice enough to tell me about Flickering Stars, Mark. This is another sci-fi spaceship dexterity game that I'm going to look more into. It looks very interesting. Another, I love that type of thing. This is done by Matt Leacock and going to be put out by Friendly Skeleton Games. And so I'll have to see how that pans out.
Matt Leacock has done some good stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah. So French Revolution news now. If you have been following the Republican calendar, as I'm sure everyone has. Oh, yeah.
It's on my phone.
You realize that Fructidor is almost over, and that is the 12th month of the Republican calendar. And we are about to head into the 5 days of Republican holidays, which means it's time to get your new French Republican calendar from Karate Fight Publishing.
It comes with a croissant.
It does not, actually. Oh. This is what we call a lie. Oh. I have a French Republican calendar on my wall. It is useless as a date tracking implement, but it is a marvelous, marvelous...
Do you see this, Mark? Do you, yeah, see? This is the look of surprise on my face that you have a French calendar on the wall.
It's time, Walker. We're about to start Republican year 232. Oh. I'm just saying, this is the month to get your French Republican calendar from Karate Fight Publishing. It's joyous, it's marvelous, and I'm going to claim that there's a board gaming hook because there are games about the French Revolution. Anyway, that's... that.
There was revolutions in France?
No.
No. Mark, we like Tikal, or I like Tikal. So Super Meeple is going to put out an edition of Tikal called Tikal Legendary. And it's sort of like the old school, like when they put out Conquest, where you could play the new advanced version of Conquest, or you could also play old school. That's what this is going to be.
Okay.
You can play the old school Tikal if you want with this, or you can play the new Tikal Legendary, whatever that's going to be.
It's been too long. I should play Tikal again.
It's developed by Tertzi, so... could be good.
Oh, interesting.
For those who care, Tikal is also on Board Game Arena. And so you could try it on there. It was a great sort of, you have a set number of action points. And so you're doing a plethora of different things, moving adventurers around, trying to get the majority on these temples that you can uncover to make worth more points. But making them worth more points will make other people want them and therefore flood more adventurers there, which will make it harder for you to get the area majority. All sorts of interesting stuff like that. Tikal is a great game.
This is a multiple of five. We don't like shilling it too much, but we have a Patreon. So if you're interested in supporting us, keeping our media free and independent, you can find us on patreon.com/swag. There is, I think, what could best be described as a cornucopia of bonus content available. You can check it all out there. We don't want to go into too much detail because we don't want to waste your time. Moving on. That is the news and why it doesn't matter. We are now going to be moving on to the topic, which is collection organization. So I think we should first off address something and give a little bit of disclosure.
Okay.
Just for context, because we've mentioned it in the past, but it's worth mentioning. We have abandoned the Kallax lifestyle.
I was going to say, watch where you swing that arm, Mark. You're going to knock over a pile of games.
Don't care that too. So we've abandoned the Kallax lifestyle. We have both resorted independently to the metal utility shelving.
Well, down here, but I, yes, wanted to be told I do have a 5x5 upstairs.
Okay, that is fair. That is fair. Yes.
Full disclosure.
Yes, but that 5x5, as I understand it, it represents a minority of your holdings.
I would say so.
Sure. And frankly, if you have a large and diverse collection, as we both do, being chained to the Kallax is sometimes a little bit limiting. Because the number of games that cannot fit into a Kallax is limited, but the problem is, the moment you've got any, your life becomes chaotic. And it's just a whole helter-skelter problem.
So let's start by saying, how is yours organized now?
Okay, so... I've actually very recently engaged in a new project of organization because my basement, where I have the finest unfinished basement in all the land.
The finest of all unfinished basements.
I've never seen an unfinished basement so fine. For one thing, I don't have to stoop over while walking in it. And for another, it's very well lit and it is extremely dry. And so I'm a big fan of my unfinished basement. Now, granted, I have to share a tenancy with the Spider Lord and the Spider Lord's denizens, but we have a comfortable arrangement.
There's an agreement.
There's sort of detente. If the Spider Lord and any of his minions or servants doesn't just dangle right in front of my face, I let them live and they take care of any other.
I feel as though they help you out. They sort of tell you which games have not been moving in a while and which ones you should play.
Oh, no.
There's like a little web there. It's like, oh, you're right. Thank you, Spider-Lord. I have not played that in a while. No, I will, in fact, you know, try this one now.
The Spider-King mostly just helps patrol and keep the basement free of any other denizens. So the spiders and I, we have an understanding. Anyway, I employed Chip the Third to help me clean out the basement every once in a while because there are two big problems related to my hobby. One of them is the sheer number of boxes that you need to flatten on the reg, things coming in, things going out. It used to be the case that I was engaged enough trading that I needed all that packing material available. But the problem is that now my box intake exceeds my box output. So every once in a while we have a big box flattening party. But anyway, setting all that aside, I have decided at long last to introduce some measure of organization to my collection. I have decided to put the two-player only games into their own section. So far, this has not been super helpful because I haven't had many opportunities to have two-player gaming since I've done this. This is a very, very recent development, but it just didn't seem to make sense to me. Some people engage in, well, we'll talk about this later, in very, very minute, fine-grained levels of organization. I don't do that, but the two-player-only game seemed to be sufficiently different that it didn't need to be the situation whereby, for example, Claustrophobia 1643 should be next to, say, A Feast for Odin or something. The circumstances under which those would be pulled out are so radically different that it seemed best to me to organize them into a separate area. Does that make any sense?
It does. For me, I have two areas, as you well know. I have the 5x5 upstairs, and then I have this metal shelving down here. So I have two separate gaming storage areas.
How's that working out for you?
Not great, but it is a necessary evil.
Okay.
So upstairs, we have the large swing of things. I have an area that has all the new stuff and stuff I want to learn and stuff I want played right now. And then on the other side, I have stuff that I want to keep, but I know will not get to the table anytime soon.
Mm.
And then beside that, there is a small section of family and children party games. So they're available for upstairs when we have the children over. They're right there ready to go.
I don't like it when you call me the children walker.
I'm sorry.
I find it very offensive. Also, where are my nuggies? I want my chicken nuggies.
I want my nuggies.
I want them shaped like dinosaurs, Walker.
Downstairs, there is no organization whatsoever.
Yes.
If there is a spot, I stuff a game. And on top of that, if the game sticks out enough, I get to pile games on that little ledge that game has created.
Okay, well, this actually, I'm actually exaggerating the extent to which my collection is completely disorganized. There are some other levels of organization. We'll get to those later. But this is the bane, I think, of many a board game collector, the small box games. Doesn't matter whether you run the Kallax lifestyle, doesn't matter whether you run the utility shelving lifestyle, doesn't matter what it is really hard to store them well. Give me a stack of Ticket to Ride size boxes, whatever. I mean, hell, pile them on the floor, as we have both been known to do on occasion. Ain't no thing. But Oink games, the smaller card boxes, something the size and shape of Gnar or Ghost Blitz or whatever, ugh. It's really hard, and it's doubly hard because since their frontage is so small, it's not the kind of thing where you can just glance over and be reminded of their existence. And so consequently, I find it very much, much harder to keep those great fillers in circulation than it does some of the more reliable big box stuff.
It's true. IKEA has these great bins you can buy for the Kallax.
But aren't they cloudy?
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
Is that at first I had just dumped all the small games into these bins and it's like, oh, that's great. Look, it holds a whole bunch of them. But then they're out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah.
And they never got, so out they came.
Yeah. Like drawers and shelving units and all that kind of thing. There's got to be, Like, every time there's a new Kickstarter for organizational schemes, I'm waiting for something that looks like it will deal with small box games in a sort of cost-effective way, because that I would totally go in for. If there's some kind of, I don't know, maybe even 3D printable solution or some off-the-shelf thing, like, maybe next what I need to do is just take another serious look at the local dollar stores. We have two different chains of dollar stores because we're a very metropolitan environment. We are in Kingston.
Whew.
So I could check both the tree and the Rama of the dollar areas and see if there's anything, because it's so rough. The way I do it with my utility shelving is I just stack them up pell-mell on the very, very top shelf. But then again, it's all already kind of out of sight, out of mind. But the problem is you can't put them on the other big shelves. It's ungainly and a problem.
I think that you can put up a shelf on its own somewhere along the high, and then you just line them all up.
I don't know, man.
It should be in the gaming area as well.
It is one thing, though, to take the second box off a four-box stack, right? It is another thing to take the seventh box out of a 10-box stack. That's asking for trouble.
It's true, but I don't want to categorize all these small boxes as the same thing, but they all normally fall into the same category. They are usually a quick-played card game or a filler game.
Usually, yes.
And
yes.
Having them accessible and insight all the time is just going to be beneficial for them.
I agree. I wish I could find a way to do it. Now, the other forms of organization that I have is I do have, like you, one of the sections of shelf for games that really need to get played soon. Sadly, there's been a bit of a backlog. I think that something happened over the course of the past couple months. I don't know if you remember.
Literally don't remember.
Your words, not mine. And so there's that. I used to spend more time doing this. When I had a smaller collection, I used to derive considerable joy from putting like with like. And so these are all my Avalon Hill bookshelf games. Ooh, maybe now I should get more bookshelf games because they'll all line up and match. And ooh, this is all the games from P.D. Verlag from Matt Gertz, and I'm going to stack them all together. I do that a lot less.
I have to say that I did go through a period where that actually worked as well and was done. It's like, because Fantasy Flight Games had the same boxes, and they sort of had the same sort of, like, they put their logo and stuff out, so they look great, you know, and you had the Devier game section and Queen Games sort of had the same sort of look of, you know, and you could it looked great, but not going
to
happen.
But then, of course, you also had to play Fantasy Flight Games, and that was a bit of a
don't
problem.
Don't be mean. There are some fantastic Fantasy Flight games.
Sure, like Beowulf the Legend. They distributed the crap out of that game they had nothing to do with. And so I still do it to a certain extent with I probably shouldn't have slagged that because now I'm opening myself wide open. I still do that with GMT games. For some reason, I keep my GMT games all together. I probably should stop doing that. But then again, it is nice. I mean, it's good to put them all together. Insert Walker comment, so now you can ignore them all, close brackets. But also,
so you don't have to see the cover. That's even better reason to do that.
Get it all out. You have any others?
No, I'll wait.
You want one or two more?
No, I'll wait.
Oh, you're going to spread them out?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Fine enough. But it's just the circumstance under which you're going to resort to almost all of the GMT catalog, again, is not exactly the kind of thing where it's like, well, we could play Gnar, we could play Feast for Odin, or we could play Triumph and Tragedy. It just didn't really work that way.
That's true. Now, Let's do this now because, you know, we get all this is where the comments were going to come.
Let's do it.
Are you going to store your games standing up? Or
vertically,
are you going to store your games lying down?
I almost invariably only resort to vertical storage for when there's just that last few inches on the shelf. I mostly do it horizontally because I don't like having to remember whether or not this kind of game can be jostled without everything flying all over the place. I'm willing to deal with the pressure and a little bit of box lid bowing and things of that nature. You're largely of the same mind, I understand it.
Yeah, well, upstairs in the Calyx, they're all vertical.
Oh, really?
I do a lot of bagging, so
okay,
a lot of my stuff can be, you know, stood up, and I'm usually keep it pretty safe that way.
And is that your preference?
Yes.
Why is that?
Just because you can see them a lot easier. You don't have to lift anything. You just say, I want that game, and pull it out, and you're ready to go.
That's true.
On the wire racks here, unfortunately, it just usually works out. It's a lot harder on the games.
It is.
Because of I wanted maximum shelves.
So absolutely.
You set it to a certain height, and it just is very damaging to the games to try to fit them in that way. So
it's true.
There are a lot of ones stacked here.
I've sometimes imagined, I just like to stress, I have, despite the fact that I grew up poor and there have been some other things, I've lived a life of extraordinary privilege. And I very rarely am in a position where I have occasion to look enviously at the possessions of other people, to be covetous about such things. But nonetheless, on occasion, on rare occasions, I do speculate what I would do with infinite quantities of money.
Yes. Right?
One of the things I would probably do with infinite quantities of money is I would finish my basement and have built-in shelving units all over the place. And I could build them to spec. And they would never get finished because the specs would be like, this shelf is 5/8 of an inch by whatever. It's like, did you make a little cubby just for fairy tale? Yes. Moving on. And so on and so forth. I like, utility shelving is great. It's very inexpensive. It's very durable. Holds all my collection. But you're right. It is not ideal. It has deficits even beyond the fact that it is not particularly aesthetically pleasing.
So on that sort of note that you just said, as much money as you can have, but what would be your optimal, so you have all the room that you need,
uh-huh,
all the shelving that you want,
uh-huh,
what would be your optimal organizational board game theme?
Oh, well, that's a good question. Well, so as I say, you know, finish the basement and built-in shelving units. Okay, so first of all, let me say something that I'd consider but then reject. Are you familiar with those movable shelves that some libraries have?
Yes.
Where they're all stacked together, but then you operate by crank to move them over.
There was almost a couple year period where I had those with these utility shelves because they're on wheels, and I would have
I'd be too nervous to actually roll them on the wheels.
I'd have them all stacked.
Oh, wow.
Together, and then I had room to like pull them apart. Like one human space at a time. So I want to look down this one. And it became too much of a pain.
Fascinating. Yeah, my dentist's office doesn't have many, but it does have those movable shelves operated by crank. I just think they're so cool. They wouldn't really be useful for game collections. It wouldn't be necessary if stipulating infinite space. But that is one thing that I would vaguely consider just because it's so neat and then reject. Honestly, I think it would just be, I'd have a little bit more space for churn. I just have enough empty shelves for things that I'm in the process of getting rid of, or just a place where it can go. Because other than that, I'm reasonably pleased with the way I've got things now. I've got my GMT section. I've got the sort of four shelf spread of the stuff that I know I'm never getting rid of, that is not going to be listed for trade, not going to send to patrons. Well, I mean, maybe if a patron really desperately needed it or something, I'd consider. Then I've got the shelf for things that I need to get played. And then there's a whole bunch of everything else. And I'm reasonably happy with that setup. I mean, I could organize it slightly better. Again, with a little bit more room, I could make things so that the stacks were nice and neat, right? I wouldn't have to worry about, well, it's going here because it fits. But other than that, I'm reasonably happy with things.
I think the biggest question we always have when we want to play a game is like how many players are. And I think stacking them in number of players, like,
I've considered it, but then rejected it.
Not so much like 1 through 4. Yeah, that's fine. I just have 1 through 4 section. And then I would have like the 6, 7, and 8 because they're.
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean? Because they're a little bit more limiting. Like there's not as many of those. So if we have 7 players, it's like I'll go to the 7 player section. It's like, okay, well, there's party ones at the top and they go down in sort of difficulty of what.
You party know. At the top, business at the bottom?
Just so. Yeah. That's how we roll.
My bottom's all business all the time. Yeah, no, I guess that's kind of an extension of what I've done with the two-player only games, because then the problem is I want to keep it strictly limited, because then the moment you start casting your net slightly wider, things get real complicated real fast. And for some people, it might work, but not for me. For example, like, would I put a game that is best with two in that section? No. The section for two-player games is for two-player only games.
Yes.
At the time where, because some people have done that, it's like, this is the section best with 3. This is the section best with 4. This section best. No. That's nightmarish to me. First of all, I maintain that not all games fit into those little categories. Some people I've met insist that every game has an ideal player count. I don't necessarily know what that is. And I don't know.
BGG will tell you.
I know BGG will tell you. Right. Well, if you wanted to just organize things on that criterion and necessarily accept whatever BGG told you, that would be a way to do it at least clearly. And then you could even look it up later if you forgot where it went, if your collection's that big and you needed to track it down. But I agree with you that the sort of a corollary to the two-player only section, I could see the virtue in a more six or more section, because yeah. that is a very narrow niche. I don't think you'd be in too much danger of leaving some games out that could be misconstrued as belonging elsewhere in that case.
On a quick note, which I love because I'm Board Game Geek, they have the dimensions in all the boxes.
Yes.
And there's an actual app
I've played with
that has Kallaxes in it that you can import your collection and it will tell you how to optimally stack your games in a Kallax.
I fiddled around with that for a little bit. The problem is that there are so many expansions.
Yes, if you have any box lift, then you're done.
And the problem is that some expansion boxes I've kept, most of them are in the base game, but I'd have to go through and differentiate each one. And on top of that, editions. Different editions just open up a whole nightmare. And at the point where you've got a collection of, you know, 40 games, yeah, that's great. You have the time to go through and play with that and, like, see what they recommend, not necessarily do it. But at the point where you'd have to make hundreds of corrections and page through to the dimensions and then, wait, what? Do I have to measure this thing again? No.
Yeah, and then you get a new game. It has to be squeezed in somewhere.
Well, then you have to,
then the app says, okay, redo all of this.
Well, no, then the app tells you to burn your house down and you start from scratch. It's what you do. Yeah, I wish that there was a way to actually, sorry, let me back up. In a universe of infinite space and infinite money, I've actually thought about this too. I would put somebody on payroll. I'm serious. I would get myself the reason why I call some of the people my acquaintance as a joke Chip is the original Chip. The original joke of Chip was some friends and I were discussing in the context of tabletop miniatures games. Wouldn't it be great if we knew like some local high schooler or something that we could pay to manage all our gaming time? It's like, yo, Chip, we are going to be playing Gaslands tomorrow at 4 p.m. Set up the table, print up our army lists and have it ready for us. And, you know, pay them whatever that's worth or whatever. In a universe where I had all these resources, I would have someone manage my stuff, be my literal steward.
It's true. And why be like, you? Yeah.
And then you have
butlers and other things.
I would use the term librarian.
True. No,
archivist.
No, I know. But I mean, like, they could even learn the game and they could.
That would be truly the next level.
Be,
yeah.
They could be there and make sure.
I would hire somebody and a new game come in and I would say, yo, archivist. Punch, sort this sucker. We're going to be playing it tomorrow at 3. Have it set up and ready to teach us. You can play if you want. Yeah, that would be the pinnacle of organizational perfection, because I would then no longer be responsible for organizing.
And obviously the best use of any money that you'd get, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. By the way, support us on Patreon.
Make this dream come true.
So that's going to do it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. We appreciate your deciding to have this spend the time with us. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. There's so much information. Walker would say there's a plethora of useful things at sowronggames.com.
Yes, I didn't get a chance to talk about it. Like, it's not only things that you'll get from now on. You'll get the backlog of so many hours.
Yes, if you support us on Patreon, but yep. that's not sowronggames.com. That's, people are going to get confused now, Walker.
I'm very sorry.
Yeah, okay.
My head's down in shame.
As well it should be at all times. Take care, everybody. Take care of your hobby. Take care of yourselves. And as always, thank your rules explainer.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Biggin. Special thanks goes to What Does It Eat for generously allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our theme. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. You can reach us by email at soverywrongaboutgames@gmail.com or on Twitter at sowronggames. Thanks very much. See you next time. And always, try to be right, but remember you are so very wrong.
This podcast is brought to you by the Marvel vs. Capcom Fighting Collection Arcade Classics. 7 legendary titles, including X-Men vs. Street Fighter and Marvel vs. Capcom 2. Enjoy new features like online multiplayer, training, and gallery modes. Plus, join in on the action with one-button specials, where players of all skill levels can unleash those epic moves with ease. Relive the classic arcade battles. Get your hands on the Marvel vs. Capcom Fighting Collection today. Available now on PlayStation 4, PC, and Nintendo Switch.